Hi there, it's Marco. Because you listen to The World, you know that we've been closely following the war in Ukraine for months, even as it was just beginning to develop. Correspondents Daniel Offman and Duri Buscarin brought you stories from the ground in Ukraine and Romania as the conflict escalated. We've been able to call on experts like Bill Browder to discuss the impact of sanctions against Russia. And you've heard from the people at the center of these events, like Oksana Kolesnik, who fled Chernihiv with her daughter and is now the director of the new Warsaw Ukrainian School in Poland. The World's reporting has helped you better understand the war in Ukraine. This kind of nuanced, human-centered reporting is only possible because of listener support. Please consider donating now to our fundraiser before June 30th. You can make your gift and learn more at theworld.org/give or follow the link in our episode notes. Help power our newsroom today at theworld.org/give. Thanks, and now the show.
As Americans wrestle with gun violence, we look for role models in different countries. It hasn't been an easy problem to solve in other places either.
We had death threats and bomb scares, and it was very rocky ride.
Still, they did it. A gun control campaigner from the UK tells us how they banned handguns. I'm Jason Margolis. Also today, immigration news out of the Summit of the Americas, plus an update on Iran's nuclear program.
So every gram of uranium in Iran, from cradle to grave, was under the IAEA's monitoring.
Not anymore. And Boston Celtics fans say their success is all about their new coach.
Yeah, Nigerians were born leaders. So when we come to the foreign countries, we work extremely hard to succeed, right?
That and more ahead on The World. This is The World. Welcome to Friday. I'm Jason Margolis, in for Marco Werman. We begin our coverage today in Los Angeles, where the Summit of the Americas is concluding. It was a meeting that started with division and discord, but President Biden wanted to end the week on a high note. Today, the U.S. unveiled a long list of measures to confront the migration crisis in the Western Hemisphere and pledged hundreds of millions of dollars to tackle the problem. Earlier today, I spoke with Mark Feuerstein, who is at the summit in Los Angeles. He's a senior advisor at the Center for Strategic and International Studies. I asked him what was promised in L.A. today.
Well, a number of things. As you noted, there wasn't much discord going into the summit, but I think it's been quite successful if you look at the declarations and the announcements that have been made here. You noted, for example, migration, and there is going to be an announcement today with regard to a hemispheric approach on migration. I think the countries in the region recognize that it's a problem that has to be tackled regionally. So I think you'll see an important accord there. The United States has also made a number of announcements with regard to its support for economic growth and equity in the region. And I'm hopeful we'll see some sort of an agreement with regard to the collective defense of democracy as well.
Right. I should say it's late morning in Los Angeles as we're recording this interview, and we're expecting the declaration of migration later in the day. Do we know what that will entail a little bit more and who's going to sign on to this?
Well, ideally, every country that's present here will sign on to it. And I think it'll involve a few things. First, every country will commit to providing legal pathways for migrants, giving them an opportunity to stay in their country and to work legally. I think there will also be an effort to support those countries to absorb and integrate migrants. I mean, Colombia, for example, as you know, has attracted and integrated millions of people from Venezuela. I think there'll be some agreements with regard to border security as well. So it'll be a fairly holistic approach to the migration challenge.
And what kind of weight does this agreement have when a leader goes back to their country with a piece of paper that was signed? Is it law, or do they have to get it approved by their legislatures?
Well, yeah, this is obviously a domestic challenge for every country, and we have a challenge in this country with regard to migration. And of course, it's a divisive issue here, and it's a divisive issue in other places. But I think when a president, you know, agrees publicly with his or her counterparts to take measures with regard to migration, I think it does carry some weight. But ultimately, I think this is the first step. It's going to require every country to pass its own legislation, to take its own measures, to implement what's ultimately agreed to here.
Right. And you mentioned that migration is not the only topic on the table there. Trade was a big one. And interestingly, China, we learned this week, has surpassed the U.S. as the main trading partner with every Latin American nation except Mexico. That was in Reuters. What can the U.S. do to curb Chinese influence in its own backyard?
Well, as you noted, you know, China is now the number one trading partner in many countries in the region, and that's a trend that's been happening for some time. And China's role can be positive if China plays by the rules of the game. And I think one thing the United States is trying to encourage other countries to do is to require China to operate transparently, to respect labor laws, to respect environmental laws, not to engage in corruption. If that happens, then China can be a very positive actor in the region. To date, we haven't really seen that. You know, China plays by different rules, unfortunately.
How much progress do you think was made here when we look back and say, back in June 2022, this happened in Los Angeles? Will this be a summit we remember, or too hard to say?
I think it's hard to say now, but I'm hopeful that with regard to migration, for example, we're going to see a lot of action coming out of this in the coming months and coming years. Similarly, I'm hopeful on the economic front we'll see the same. I think the collective defense of democracy has become more challenging because, as President Biden has said, there is a battle for a global battle between democracy and autocracy. That's taking place, of course, in the United States as well, as we saw last night with the January 6th committee hearings. And, you know, in some ways, democracy is not necessarily as consolidated in the hemisphere as we hoped it would be. But that said, I think it's important for leaders to come together and agree on certain principles. It's a requirement for not just governments to go back, but for civil society to go back, for private sector to go back and collectively work on these issues.
Mark Feirstein is a senior advisor at the Center for Strategic and International Studies. He was also a senior official in the Obama and Biden administrations. Mark, thanks so much for joining us.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me.
And now for an update about an old virus that has been making a new appearance. The World Health Organization reports that more than 1,000 cases of monkeypox have been identified in more than 24 countries, nations that don't typically see the viral disease. There have been no deaths, but the spread of monkeypox has put more places on alert. The World's Alana Gordon reports on what we know and how we got here.
Monkeypox is a virus that was first identified in humans in the 1970s. It's usually spread from animals like squirrels and rodents to humans in regions of Central and Western Africa. This new outbreak marks the first time extensive human-to-human spread has occurred at this scale outside those regions. So in places like the UK, the US, the UAE, Spain, Australia. It means the virus may have been spreading undetected for some time. Dr. Bahuma Ditanji, a virologist at Emory University, says we shouldn't be so surprised.
We have known for the past 50 years that monkeypox could cause infection in humans. It has been causing sporadic outbreaks in endemic countries, and over the years, these outbreaks have become more frequent. This is established. We have known this.
Ditanji is from Cameroon and has previously responded to monkeypox outbreaks there. She says they've had tools to contain the spread and opportunities to learn more about this virus, but it's gone under the radar because, she says, of who's most affected.
They tend to be people who are from very resource-limited settings, and also people who may not have the loudest voice on the global scene. And not only with monkeypox, if you look at malaria and if you look at other neglected diseases of the poor.
That neglect is now catching up in the middle of this COVID-19 pandemic. David Heyman is an epidemiologist at the London School of Hygiene and Tropical Medicine. He's also responded to monkeypox outbreaks in the past. He says this virus differs from COVID. It's rectangular, heavier, and doesn't evolve as quickly.
The major means of transmission is an open sore on a person who has monkeypox and is in physical contact with any portion of the skin of a person who's not infected.
The CDC recently created confusion over conflicting messages about whether people should mask when traveling and whether this can be transmitted easily in the air. Heyman doesn't think so. Scientists are still learning more. But he says close physical contact is the main risk.
And the good news, of course, is that we can all prevent ourselves from getting infected if we take precautions, if we think we're going to have close physical contact with someone who might have monkeypox.
Communities are also starting to better monitor cases. Some vaccines developed for monkeypox's cousin, smallpox, have been shown to be effective. So in some places that have these vaccines, like Spain, close contacts are starting to get vaccinated. Supply is limited, though. The spread has been happening through social networks, especially among networks of men who have sex with men. Dr. Ditanji, who also works on another virus, HIV, says lessons from the early days of AIDS remind her of how important it is now to not alienate any one community. Monkeypox can infect anyone.
We can communicate about risk groups without stigmatizing.
Last week, hundreds of researchers got together virtually to map out what's known and unknown about these latest outbreaks. Some open questions include whether this virus may be able to transmit before visible symptoms like those lesions emerge. This is a mild strain of monkeypox. A deadlier version has long circulated in Central Africa and already killed at least 60 people this year. Scientists want to know how this mild strain affects those who are immunocompromised, very young and pregnant people. Tatanji sees a real need to act fast for another reason, so this virus doesn't settle into animals in non-endemic countries, leading to more and more outbreaks. WHO's director Tedros Ghebreyesus told reporters this week that he hopes this situation serves as a bigger wake-up call for the world.
It's an unfortunate reflection of the world we live in that the international community is only now paying attention to monkeypox because it has appeared in high-income countries. The communities that live with the threat of this virus every day deserve the same concern, the same care, and the same access to tools to protect themselves.
Like COVID, scientists say we need to develop better global responses to global problems. For the world, I'm Alana Gordon.
Golf fans have some new tournaments to watch. The LIV Golf Series. It's attracted a few high-profile golfers with rich cash prizes. But today, the commissioner of the PGA, the Professional Golfers Association, said that all players competing in the LIV are now suspended from the PGA Tour. The LIV Golf Series is sponsored by Saudi Arabia's Sovereign Wealth Fund, and a lot of people say the Saudis are using golf to clean up their image, an example of sports washing. To make sense of this, we turn to Christian Ulrichsen. He's a professor at Rice University's Baker Institute for Public Policy, where he studies the Middle East and Gulf states. So, Professor Ulrichsen, what's the genesis of this LIV Golf Series?
I think we've seen two things come together. There was certainly an element of individual golfers, including Greg Norman, a former champion from the 1990s, who felt they wanted to shake up the world of professional golf, and they needed someone to come and back them financially. And I think that's how the Public Investment Fund got involved. What they're doing is effectively going to individual players and saying, we'd like you to sign up and play in our tournaments. And of course, the PGA Tour has responded by saying, if you do that, then you can't play on the tour. So we've seen the players desiring to do something different. They've now found their backer. And of course, that backer is from Saudi Arabia.
Right. So Greg Norman, a famous golfer, wants a new type of tournament. He turns to the Saudis who have cash. Is it just that simple, or were the Saudis involved saying, hey, you know, we would like to do something to burnish our image?
Well, first of all, the governor of the Public Investment Fund, Yasser Al-Ramayan, is a huge golfing fan himself. But of course, the Public Investment Fund has got involved as well. And they've been involved in other aspects of getting in more deeply engaged in sport. They bought Newcastle United in the English Premier League. They've gotten involved in world wrestling. They've become much more involved in Formula One. And I think they're looking to get people talking about Saudi Arabia in a different way, focusing not on human rights issues, on the killing of Jamal Khashoggi in 2018, on the war in Yemen, but instead they want to be talking about Saudi Arabia as a country of young people that is engaging in sport in many different areas. And so I think they're trying to shift that conversation.
Right. And who is Saudi Arabia trying to woo over by this? Is there anyone in particular that they're trying to impress?
Well, they may be trying to reach a new constituency in the sense that golf is maybe more of an affluent sport. The people that play and watch golf are perhaps the type of constituency that the Public Investment Fund is trying to reach. So it could be that. I think it's also interesting that two of the five events played in the United States will be played at golf courses owned by Donald Trump. And we have seen over the past several years how, if you want to get close to Trump, golf and using his courses are perhaps one way of doing so. And so I think there's a whole range of constituencies that they're trying to reach in launching this rival series of events and in trying to persuade golfers to come over with enormous promises of financial backing.
Right. $200 million to Phil Mickelson, I believe.
Well, yes, and it's really a challenge to the status quo. So in a sense, this is a step up from buying one soccer club out of 20 in the Premier League. It would be the equivalent of setting up a rival Premier League and then almost daring the players to make a choice.
And we've used the term sports washing here as if it's a negative, which I think most people think of it as a negative thing. But couldn't we also argue that sports bring people together? And what's so wrong with sponsoring a golf tournament and bringing some entertainment?
Well, yes, sports does bring people together in a sense that we saw with Newcastle, we saw tens of thousands of Newcastle supporters outside the stadium cheering the takeover by the Saudis in October last year. And that was a very powerful image. And so absolutely, there's an element of supporting sport. I think it's part of a broader shift over two decades now in terms of globalizing sport away from its traditional centers. And I think this is part and parcel of that wider process.
Christian Urlichsen is a professor at Rice University's Baker Institute for Public Policy. He's been speaking about the controversy around the Saudi Arabian-sponsored LIV Golf Series. Professor Urlichsen, thank you for explaining all of this.
No, thank you.
You're listening to The World. I'm Jason Margolis. This is The World. On March 13th, 1996, this was the top story in the UK.
Reports are coming in that one person is dead and several people have been injured after a shooting incident at Dunblane Primary School.
The small town of Dunblane in central Scotland is tonight in deep shock and mourning after the massacre today of 16 children.
I feel sure that I speak for all of you today in wishing to express our grief for those at Dunblane.
Queen Elizabeth led her nation in mourning that week. Like the horrific attack in Uvalde, Texas, the massacre at Dunblane Primary School in Scotland led to calls for greater gun control. In the UK, those calls were answered with legislation. Jill Marshall-Andrews helped organize the successful effort to ban handguns in the UK. My colleague Marco Werman reached her in London.
Jill, take us back to March 1996 and the aftermath of the mass shooting in Dunblane. What was the mood?
Well, it was a public outrage. I mean, it was shock, obviously, but it was outrage and disgust. And the sense very quickly emerged that the public thought, well, we don't need these handguns. We don't need all this.
So when you say we, Jill, talk about your campaign. How and why did you turn outrage and grief into action?
Well, before 1996, I had heard our chief police officer of the Metropolitan Police say on television that it wouldn't be long before all our police were routinely armed. And this was the American way, and that we in the UK habitually followed America about 15 years later. Mm. And I thought, maybe we don't have to go down the American road. And so I tried to set up an organization to tighten up gun control, and nobody was interested. But after Dunblane, I made contact with the families who lived in Dunblane and who started a petition. And together we campaigned for a complete ban on handguns. And the media got behind us. Everybody wanted to help us. You know, it was a huge national exercise, a tide of public opinion. And the only reason that politicians wanted this to happen was that they feared for their jobs if it didn't happen.
So, you know, we see a lot of hand-wringing and some campaigning after mass shootings here in the U.S., but ultimately we see little action from lawmakers. What was it about your campaign, Jill, that convinced lawmakers in the U.K. to act?
Well, we had a very clear goal, and I think that's very important. It's no good just campaigning for more gun control. You've got to be campaigning for something. And we wanted a complete ban on handguns. It wasn't enough just to make them more secure. We wanted a ban on handguns. And that was ambitious. We were told at the time that pistol shooting was the fastest growing sport in the UK. That showed clearly that we were going down the American road. So we thought, okay, well, let's stop that.
Was there any pushback, like from the growing cohort of pistol shooters?
Oh, we had death threats and bomb scares, and it was very rocky ride. Mm. But you have to decide whether you want to carry on or whether you're just going to wring your hands, I suppose. And we decided we were going to hang on.
And how long did you have to hang on for? How quickly did lawmakers act to ban pistols and handguns?
Well, it was a very lucky coincidence. We were heading for a general election when Dunblane happened. So we started off by approaching the opposition, the Labour Party opposition, And they quite quickly agreed with us. So we had one political party that was committed, and that pushed the Conservatives to taking some action. So we had our first piece of legislation was in early 1997.
Yeah, so a year after Dunblane.
Yes, that was the first piece of legislation, but that just put handguns into clubs.
So like shooting clubs.
Yes, into shooting clubs. So you weren't allowed to have one at home. But from our point of view, that wasn't sufficient. So when the Labour Party won the next general election and Tony Blair came in as Prime Minister, the first piece of legislation he brought in was the complete ban of handguns that had been in the Labour manifesto. So that was a lucky piece of politics.
So this was a ban on handguns. Did gun control laws in the UK also cover semi-automatics, a kind of rapid fire weapons often used in mass shootings here in the US?
Yes. We had an earlier atrocity in 1987 in Hungerford. And after that, assault rifles were banned.
So obviously Britain does not have a Second Amendment like we do in the US, nor the kind of gun culture found here. But what are the things you learned in your effort in the UK that you think would help gun control advocates here in the US?
I don't think I can teach anybody anything. I mean, each situation is different. Each country is different. All I can tell you is how it happened here. And it did happen here because it was a very clear message. We all agreed on it. We had the media on our side, and it was across the board, right wing, left wing. The politicians thought, this is the public mood here is such that I am going to lose my seat if I don't go along with this.
So this community in Dunblane, Scotland in 1996, the community experienced trauma and there was a decisive response to it. How does that affect the way victims have moved forward from Dunblane?
I think that the families of the victims, the parents of the children, found great solace in being part of a group. And they became a very powerful voice, which politicians listened to. And if they hadn't been that cohesive group, I think we might have had a different outcome.
So is just being persistent, is that your main advice?
I don't want to be offering advice, but what I would say has worked for us is that the victims and the survivors are hugely powerful and hugely important in any campaign. They are in a way untouchable by the shooting lobby. There will be people who are very upset by the idea of taking their guns away. As I just said, we had death threats, we had bomb threats. You know, it was a very rocky ride. So it doesn't happen easily. But if you are yourself affected, you have a power and a credibility that, you know, can really make a difference.
That was Jill Marshall-Andrews, co-founder and chair of the UK's Gun Control Network. She was telling my colleague Marco Werman about the effort she helped lead to ban handguns in Britain. One of the most stressful parts about taking an international trip during the pandemic has been getting that COVID test. Finding a testing location, getting the results within a 24-hour window, and of course, passing the test. Today, some welcome news for American travelers heading abroad this summer. You can go, enjoy your trip, and not have to worry about a test to get back home. The CDC is set to lift the testing requirement on Sunday at midnight. The agency said the requirement was no longer necessary based on the science and data. The travel industry had been pushing for this for months. The rule also applies to foreign travelers visiting the U.S. Ditch the COVID test. Just don't forget your passport. More stories from around the globe are still coming your way. You're listening to The World. You know who is good at naming things? IKEA.
Erik, Eivor, Frode, Felicia, Fredrika, or Fritjof, for that matter.
And now IKEA is ready to name your baby. Plus, Nigerian expats are loving this run by the Boston Celtics. That's all ahead this hour on The World. I'm Jason Margolis, in for Marco Werman. This is The World. We're a co-production of GBH and PRX. Among European nations, Poland has some of the strictest laws banning abortion. Now the government appears to be taking things one step further. there are accusations that Poland is creating a pregnancy register that would document every pregnancy in the country. The health ministry says a database is being set up following a recommendation from the European Union. The World's Europe correspondent Orla Berry has the story.
Claudia Kuzdub discovered she was pregnant in March of last year. Kuzdub is from Kielce, a small city in southern Poland. It's about halfway between Warsaw and Krakow. She says she knew having a baby just wasn't the right decision for her at the time.
It just cannot happen. Like, I am not ready. I don't want it. And it wasn't planned at all. So I didn't know what to do.
2 months earlier, the government in Poland had introduced a new law banning abortion in all but the most exceptional of cases. So Kuzdub turned to the internet. She contacted a women's support group abroad. It offered to send her abortion pills in the mail. 10 days later, the medication arrived, wrapped in an unmarked envelope. Kuzdub took the pills, but she was nervous they might not have worked. So she went to the hospital in her hometown. Kuzdub tells me she was worried how the doctors would react when she told them she had taken abortion pills.
I just had a feeling like something can happen.
The doctor was an older woman, and when Kuzdub told her why she was there,
she was really, really angry. She didn't ask me how I feel, what symptoms I had. The only question was, where did you get the pills? This is illegal. I'm calling lawyer. I'm calling police. I'm calling government. Stuff like that.
The doctor told Kuzdub she'd have to stay in the hospital for a few days, but she refused and went home. Kuzdub's experience is one of the reasons why abortion rights activists in Poland are furious about the government's plans to set up a register of every pregnancy in the country. It's not a criminal offence in Poland to have an abortion. Only those found guilty of helping someone to terminate a pregnancy can be prosecuted. So the doctor in Kuzdub's case was not obliged to call the police or a lawyer. But women's rights activists fear that's exactly what will happen under this new policy. Martha Lempart is founder of the Polish rights movement Women's Strike. Lempart has reason to be suspicious of healthcare professionals in Poland. She says personal medical data is simply not secure.
My COVID test results were presented on national television before I knew them. The national healthcare system leaked my healthcare data to the public television. That's how I found out.
Most television stations in Poland are government-owned, and her COVID status made national news headlines. The Polish Health Ministry said this week that the new pregnancy register is a medical database that will also collect information like blood type and allergies. Health Ministry spokesperson Wojciech Andruszewicz told Polish television that the government is just following a directive from the European Union.
Chodzi o poszerzenie raportowanych danych, które staje się wymogiem Komisji Europejskiej. Dlaczego?
Andruszewicz said the register will help Polish citizens travelling around Europe because doctors in other EU countries will be able to access their records. Last month, the EU Commission did propose a plan to digitise medical records across the bloc, but the scheme is still only a proposal. Martha Lempart worries the police could also target people who've had a miscarriage if their pregnancy is logged into a government database.
She might be questioned, abused, treated as a suspect. I cannot even imagine, because we also have a lack of any psychological support for women that miscarried. So in this horrible state, she would be questioned and dragged and harassed.
There are already a few known cases of women who've died after doctors in Poland refused to terminate their pregnancies, even though the mothers' lives were in danger. Activists say there will be many more deaths. Doctors in Poland say they have fears too. If they decide that an abortion is necessary to save the life of a mother, they worry that they could be investigated and face prosecution. But Lempart says she doesn't have much sympathy for the medical professionals.
I don't care what their explanation is. I don't care. Women die. Not even one Polish doctor was actually charged and put in jail for providing abortion in the last 30 years. That's a lie. If they say that they're afraid of the persecutor and the police, that's a lie. They're afraid for their careers and their money.
Lempart says she's facing numerous charges herself for organising street protests, but she says she will not be silenced. Back in Kielce, Claudia Kuzdub tells me a month after visiting the hospital, Polish police came looking for her. They said they wanted to know what had happened at the hospital. But when Kuzdub agreed to speak with them, she says, it was a different story.
They were asking me only who gave me pills and who knew about the abortion. That's all. They didn't ask me about the situation in the hospital at all.
Kushtub says she doesn't know what might come of that police investigation, but she plans on leaving Poland soon and moving to Italy. It's a Catholic country, she says, but in Italy, they don't terrorise you for terminating a pregnancy. For the world, I'm Orla Barry.
It used to be referred to as the Iran nuclear deal. Now it's more like the Iran nuclear situation. The Trump administration pulled out of the 2015 deal with Iran, negotiated by the Obama administration. For months now, the Biden administration has been trying to get that agreement back on track. But negotiations are again stalled, and there's a lot riding on the outcome. Here to tell us more is Ali Vaez. He's the director of the Iran Project and senior advisor at the International Crisis Group based in Washington. Ali, this week, Iran disabled some monitoring equipment, cameras, at its nuclear facilities. The International Atomic Energy Association called that move a near-fatal blow to reviving a deal. First, what was that monitoring equipment important for, and what did it do?
Iranians have dismantled 27 cameras that were put in place as a result of the nuclear deal in 2015. And it allowed the agency for the first time to be able to monitor facilities that beforehand it really did not have access to. And this starts from uranium mines, uranium mills, all the way to waste management. So every gram of uranium in Iran from cradle to grave was under the IAEA's monitoring. This is the most comprehensive monitoring mechanism that has ever been implemented anywhere in the world.
So let's take a step back and just remind us of the big picture here. Iran has a nuclear enrichment program for energy. The U.S. and its partners want to make sure that doesn't become a nuclear weapons program. How did the original 2015 nuclear deal prevent that?
Look, the core bargain of the 2015 agreement was pretty simple. Iran agreed to roll back its nuclear program, put it in a box, and under rigorous monitoring by the IAEA in a verifiable manner. And in return, it got economic sanctions relief, so economic incentives.
What have been the major sticking points why Iran and the U.S. and its partners can't revive the deal? What's been going on in the last few months that they can't agree on?
It's difficult to boil it down to one issue. The reality is that there is a 27-page detailed agreement that is ready to be signed by both sides. And the last obstacle to that agreement was the question of the Iranian Revolutionary Guard's designation as a foreign terrorist organization by the Trump administration in 2019. The U.S.'s argument was that this is unrelated to Iran's nuclear activities, and so it has to remain in place. And Iranians saw it as a means of undermining the nuclear agreement. And so they insisted that it should be removed. And now the negotiations have been in limbo over the past 3 months because of both sides' inability to find a way to overcome this last obstacle.
Can the two sides or the many sides get this agreement over the finish line? Can they reach an agreement, do you think?
10 years ago, Prime Minister Netanyahu of Israel stood up at the UN General Assembly podium and held up a cartoon bomb and drew a red line on it. That red line was about Iran having enough fissile material enriched to high levels, which would be sufficient for a single nuclear weapon if Iran decides to enrich it to weapons grade. That breakout time, which is the amount of time needed to basically enrich enough uranium for a weapon, at that time was 4 months. That breakout time now is 6 days, and Iran has sufficient nuclear material for an arsenal of nuclear weapons, not just one. So this is not a sustainable situation, and I'm afraid by the time we get to this fall, President Biden will be faced with two unpalatable choices. Either accept Iran as a virtual nuclear weapon state, which might decide at any moment to develop a nuclear weapon, or take military action to prevent that from happening. Unless the parties show flexibility and overcome this last obstacle in the negotiations and close the deal.
So when you say 6 days, that's pretty alarming. Should we be alarmed?
It's 6 days to enrich enough material for a nuclear weapon, but that's not a nuclear weapon. You still have to manufacture that material and put it in a nuclear weapon. So the weaponization part of it is also going to take some time. Our estimates is something between 6 months to 2 years. We can monitor the enrichment part of this process of building nuclear weapons. We can't monitor the weaponization part, right? So once Iran has the material, it can move it anywhere in the country and start actually manufacturing that into a weapon. And we don't have eyes on it. So it's only the enrichment part that we can monitor, and that's why 6 days is pretty concerning. Now, you don't hear the Israelis talking about it anymore because they're not saying the sky is falling, because they know if they do that, the quickest solution to resolving this problem is the restoration of the JCPOA, because it will put Iran's nuclear program back in a box and extend the breakout time to above 6 months. And, 6 months is obviously much better than 6 days. But they don't want the JCPOA, and so they're not ringing the alarm bells now. But once the negotiations collapse, I have no doubt that they would start saying either the U.S. will have to take military action to stop the Iranians, or we will.
Ali Vaez is a senior advisor and director of the Iran Project at the International Crisis Group in Washington. Ali, thank you for your time and for explaining that to us.
Always a pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Recognize the jingle? That's an old Russian ad for McDonald's, a reminder of the deep foothold the burger giant has in a Russian pop culture. McDonald's famously opened its first restaurant in Moscow in January 1990 with huge lines, offering some 30,000 Soviet citizens a taste of American culture on just day one. Now, the run is over. Last month, McDonald's sold its restaurants across Russia following the invasion of Ukraine. McDonald's corporate office said working in Russia is no longer tenable and not, quote, consistent with McDonald's values. The iconic golden arches were quickly taken down across Russia, but some good news for fast food fans in Moscow. This Sunday, several of the now former McDonald's will reopen under a new name. The food should feel pretty familiar. Russian media have shown images of a new menu with the Filet-O-Fish renamed Fish Burger. Chicken McNuggets, drop the Mick, now simply Nuggets. After 3 decades, McDonald's Russian empire had grown to more than 800 restaurants. The new owner told Reuters he plans to reopen all of them. We're still waiting for the new name of the revamped Russian McDonald's to be revealed. The feminist movement in China has been met with serious repression. Still, Chinese women have been finding ways to support each other. That's nothing new. Centuries ago, rural women in China developed a secret language to share their struggles. Tomorrow in New York, a new documentary premieres that tells the story of two women who are trying to preserve that language. The World's Shanghai correspondent Rebecca Canther spoke with the director.
Hundreds of years ago, Chinese women came up with a language that men could not understand. It was called Nü Shu. Back then, it was common for Chinese women's feet to be bound, making it almost impossible for them to walk freely by themselves. They weren't allowed an education. They spent their days locked in their rooms, embroidering and making crafts. And they wrote this new language on handmade fans.
They created a secret language, and they would write poems and songs. And throughout the years, because of this secret language, women built this beautiful underground sisterhood and share their dignity and hope between themselves.
Film director Violet Feng grew up in China knowing nothing of Nü Shu. The language has survived to this day, passed from generation to generation. But there are only a handful of women left who can read it and write it. Feng decided to film the lives of two women, one in rural China and one in Shanghai, who are trying to preserve it.
I wanted to follow the younger generation because they're the ones who are at the crossroad dealing with navigating their identity in this context of where China is.
Feng says what interested her about the ancient Nü Shu language is how it might relate to the lives of Chinese women today.
I think that every woman's personal experience in their daily struggles is political. We're always, always struggling between the social expectations, between our traditional values, and who we want to be, our individual identities. And that dilemma is in every woman, and including myself.
Speaking about those struggles is not always welcome, and women's bodies are on the front lines. The Chinese government has abandoned its one-child policy in the hopes of boosting China's birth rate. But more and more young Chinese women are rejecting the path of marriage and children altogether.
There's still not yet a support system for women, you know, legally and socially and emotionally to help us, you know, to fulfill those kind of expectations.
Feng says that the Nü Shu language gave women some agency.
The power of it, even back then, I say it's very much the Chinese way of feminism. It's not about throwing away the system or changing the system and having protests, which is completely impossible at the time. They found a different way and they found a different approach.
Today, though, Nü Shu is being used in ways that are quite different from its original purpose. In one scene in the film, a so-called princess school uses Nü Shu to teach young girls etiquette wrapped in traditional Chinese values.
You begin to see workshops to kind of reintroduce how should women behave, how to be elegant, how to be obedient, and all of those things. And then people are using Nü Shu to kind of help women to serve those roles too, which is totally the opposite of what it was before.
Today in China, Nü Shu is also being commodified for economic gain. Government officials discuss how they can build local tourism around the language. Entrepreneurs use it to market their products. There's even a KFC ad featuring Nü Shu. In the film, the women who care the most about the language struggle with how to preserve its authenticity. But filmmaker Violet Feng says, in the end, saving the language itself is not as important as preserving that supportive space for the kind of sisterhood that Nü Shu helped create.
To me, Nü Shu is not just a language, it is art. It is a voice embedded in that art. And in that sense, as long as we carry the legacy of it, as long as it lives in our heart of every woman, I don't think it will ever die.
The film is called Hidden Letters, and it premieres tomorrow at the Tribeca Film Festival in New York. Feng hopes to show it in China, too. For The World, I'm Rebecca Kanther in Shanghai.
A little over a week ago, a lot of basketball fans thought the NBA Finals were a mere formality. The mighty Golden State Warriors were going to roll right over the Boston Celtics. Well, here in our Boston-based newsroom, we'd like to remind you that the Celtics are now leading the series 2-1. Game 4 is tonight. The Celtics are run by first-year head coach Ime Udoka. He's quickly won over a lot of people here in Boston, but his deepest fan base may be in the city's Nigerian community. GBH's Esteban Bustillos has our story.
Few people may be bigger Ime Udoka fans than Godwin Nana. Nana is president of the Nigerian American Multi-Service Association, a local nonprofit. He knew about Udoka even before he was named the head coach of the Celtics last year, not because he keeps close tabs on the NBA's coaching ranks, but because of Udoka's time playing for Nigeria's national basketball team.
So we as a community were very excited, obviously, when we saw him coming here.
There's a few big reasons for that. Udoka, whose father came to the U.S. from Nigeria, is the sixth black coach in the history of the Celtics, but he's also the first NBA coach of African origin. Now, with the Celtics looking to bring home a banner under the guidance of the first-year head coach, the local Nigerian community is beaming at the success of one of their own. While Udoka's hire came with a bit of history attached, Nigerians in the NBA are nothing new. But it's a big leap from playing in the NBA to coaching in it. Here's Nana.
It's a game that has a lot of black presence, but often don't have a lot of black coaches.
Recently, there's been notable change in the NBA on this front. Half of the league's teams currently have a black head coach. If the Celtics win these finals, Udoka would become just the seventh black coach in league history to earn a ring. Nana hopes that Udoka's presence can help continue to inspire others.
We as Nigerians see ourselves fundamentally as a part of the black story in America, and he's writing his history along those lines of being part of this racial group that has been so present in this game, but also have not had fundamentally such a presence in terms of coaching as they ought to be.
Cecilia Lazat was born and raised in Nigeria and came to the States in 1999. 10 years ago, she opened up Suya Joint, a restaurant serving Nigerian and West African dishes. Lazat, like any member of the local community, is stoked about what Udoka's done with the Celtics.
I would basically like to say, yeah, Nigerians were born leaders. So whether we like it or not, when we come to the to foreign countries, we work extremely hard to succeed, right?
Lord Aneke was one of Lazat's customers this past weekend when he and a couple of buddies visited Suya Joint for a Sunday lunch. His excitement to see Udoka take the Celtics to the finals goes beyond words.
In Nigeria, we have a saying that, you know, that goes, Naija no dey carry last. And what that means is, like, no matter what we do, we're always the best at it. We perform as high as we can, you know what I mean? So, and he's embodying that.
Even though he has his hands full with the finals, Udoka has heard what others with a Nigerian background are saying.
I heard I've been argued over what tribe my father's from, and they're trying to claim on where I came from and all that. But for me, it's a source of pride. And
now all that's left is for him to become the first Nigerian coach to take home a championship ring.
For the world, I'm Esteban Bustillos in Boston.
You might every once in a while miss out on a great story we've aired on The World. No worries, we've got you covered. TheWorld.org has stories, audio, and photography to help you connect to events around the globe. And while you're there, subscribe to our daily newsletter for a morning dose of global news. That's all at TheWorld.org. Naming your child can be stressful, not the kind of thing you'd want to later regret. But parents, don't fret. Help is on the way. From the place famous for meatballs and causing marital strife, IKEA. The World's Sarah Birnbaum reports.
Rebecca Hyams agonized over what to name her twin boys. She's German, her partner's Canadian. She needed two names that sound good in English, French, and German. A tall order.
So the first name we had at 9 weeks of pregnancy, and the second name we found at 37 weeks and 2 days after 50 hours of labor.
No. His name isn't Get Out of Me Right Now. But given Rebecca's state, it could have been.
I was very high at that point on all kinds of medication that they give you during labor. And we literally asked our cousins in the UK if they had any suggestions. And they sent us these two names from the daycare of their kids. And we were like, yep, one of them is it.
If you don't have cousins in the UK, you don't have to worry. IKEA's got your back. IKEA's Norway branch thought that the names it's given to its furniture could also work for newborns. So it went to the catalog, they're calling it their name bank, and pulled out 800 names.
We have Dagmar, Erik, Eivor, Frode, Felicia, Fredrika, or Fritjof for that matter.
That's Carl Orby. He's the CEO of IKEA in Norway. He says the idea came to them in the middle of COVID.
One of the outcomes of the pandemic is that we have kind of a baby boom here in Norway and Scandinavia. And in IKEA, we have been naming our products ever since IKEA was started in 1948. So we thought maybe we can help new families to get a unique name.
Maybe too unique for some countries. It's a running joke that Americans struggle to pronounce anything at IKEA.
Cinderlig,
Fajedrar. It's a varsarium. And right here, we got gonorrhea.
It can be hard to get your mouth around some of those vowels, but IKEA product names do have a lyrical quality.
Like Snurrad or something like Fjernemund.
Sort of lyrical. Still, as Stephen Colbert points out, you wouldn't want American furniture companies suggesting names.
That's my son, Lazy Boy. And those girls over there, they're my twins, Raymore and Flanagan.
Sure, it's a shrewd marketing ploy, but Rebecca Hyam says she would have used an IKEA naming guide.
I mean, you know, like sometimes even now when we build IKEA furniture, we're like, oh, that's a great name. That sounds lovely.
So, parents, by all means, go to the list, find a name. Just don't go into the store with your partner when you're 9 months pregnant. It won't end well. Trust me. For The World, I'm Sarah Birnbaum.
This is going to make me look at my Hoxsung closet system a little differently now. The World comes to you each weekday from the Nan and Bill Harris studio in Boston. You can find us online anytime at theworld.org. I'm Jason Margolis in for Marco Werman. Make some time to relax this weekend, and we'll see you back here on Monday.
Before we go, the podcast you just listened to is available free and on demand because listeners like you support our work. If you value our independent, fact-based journalism, please consider making a contribution before our fundraiser ends on June 30th. Visit theworld.org/give to learn more and donate, or you can follow the link in the episode notes. That's theworld.org/give. Thank you so much. From PRX.